This week's parsha is Parshat Shlach, and as we know, the major theme of Parshat Shlach is the sending of the spies, where although we don't have all the details in this week's parsha, it's filled in Sefer Devarim, wherein the Jewish people requested from Moshe Rabbeinu, we would like to send out spies. Before just walking into a land we know nothing about, let's send out spies to check out the best way to approach conquering the land, and let's see what the land is all about. So the parasha begins, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to send spies. Moshe Rabbeinu sent 12 of the top people in Klal Yisrael, one from each tribe, and they went out to spy out the land, and he gave them a whole checklist to look for. You know, HaKazakim Rafeh, is the land strong, is it weak, what type of people live in the land, etc. And the Meraglim come back, the spies come back, with the exception of Kalev and Yehoshua, they come back saying, oh no, this land is beyond hope. They're way too strong for us. There's no way we can possibly conquer the land. We're lost. It's not worth going in. And they get the whole people all excited and they begin crying. We know that famous statement of our rabbis that on the night that the Jewish people cried, God says, you cried a bechiya shochinam. You cried for nothing. I'm going to give you a reason to cry. And that's the night of Tisha B'Av, where we've known throughout Jewish history, we've been crying through the disasters that have occurred to the Jewish people on this night, whether it's the Churban Bayis, the destruction of the temple, or other major events in Jewish history. At which point God said, okay, I'm ready to wipe out the people. They don't love me. They don't believe in me. Let's just get rid of them. Moshe Rabbeinu, using the Yud Gimel Midos, the 13 attributes of mercy, pleased with God. And the punishment is that the spies died in a very, and we'll see this, a very difficult death. And the people had to die in the desert. And the next generation, after 40 years of wandering, one year per day that they spied the land, they were in the land 40 days, they were in the desert 40 years, the next generation would go into the land. The parsha ends with a different mitzvot, which are fascinating in itself. What's doing this week's parsha, but not for today. The law of Nesachim, the law of pouring wine, the law of challah, the story of the Mekoshesh who gathered wood on Shabbos, and ultimately the mitzvah of tzitzit. I think that the major question which we need to deal with today, or at least begin to approach, is what went wrong. We know that these spies, as the Torah tells us, kulam anashim, they were all righteous people. As Rashi tells us, anashim is the lashon of chashivos, of importance. These were the people we know about Kalev and Yehoshua, and these were the people on their level of caliber, if not higher. These were the greatest people in Klal Yisrael. How could the greatest leaders fool so badly that they didn't believe in God, that they said the land is too difficult for us and we'd rather not go in? How do we understand what was going on with the Meraglim? And I'll say at the outset, I'd like to note today two approaches, and they are diametrically opposite approaches. Which approach is right? It's irrelevant for me. What's relevant is that we should just be exposed to do two different approaches. The manner in which I'd like to present these approaches is to really do a text study of the first two Rashis in this week's parsha. And I'd like just really to understand, and that being, so to speak, a real focus of today, how looking at Rashi and Chumash is not just a Rashi that's telling us a story, or Rashi that's trying to convey information, but Rashi is really trying to tell us, and the Torah itself is trying to tell us, world lessons for life. And to try to understand what are these lessons that we can glean for ourselves. So I'd like to look at together now the first two Rashis, raise a number of questions, take a number of approaches of understanding Rashi, and in so doing, respond to our overall question of what happened with the miracle. So let's begin to A, this wonderful new set that came out of the art scroll, Chumash and Rashi, the linear translation is really excellent, with excellent footnotes. So this is where this comes from, 2a. Shlach lecha anashim. Alright, first pasuk tells us, we take a look in source number one, just look at the psukim. Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, send forth for yourself men, and let them spy out the land of Canaan. I give to the children of Israel one man each from his father's tribe, shall you send everyone a leader among them. So on Shlach Lecha Anashim, send for yourself men, says Rashi, why was the passage of the spies placed next to the passage of Miriam? If we look back at the end of Parshas Va'aloscha, The last story in last week's parasha was the story of how Miriam spoke Lashon Hara about her brother Moshe and how she got stricken with Sarat. So Rashi's question is, why were the two stories put together? So Rashi tells us, for she was stricken over matters of speech, which she spoke against her brother, and these wicked ones, the spies, saw what happened to her, yet did not take a lesson from her. So this is the first Rashi. It's raised a number of questions. We'll look at the second Rashi, and then we'll begin our study. Why is Rashi asking why the two are connected, the two stories? If indeed, on every single beginning of the parsha, Rashi asks this question, how come this parsha, this idea is connected to what came before, so then it would make sense to do it here. But if you look through Rashi and Chumash, it's not every parsha or every parak that Rashi asks the question, why is one thing connected with the other? What is driving Rashi to note here that there must be a connection between the sending of the spies and the story of Miriam? What is it that forces Rashi to say that there must be a connection? We must understand the connection. That's question one. Question two is a more obvious question. How can you compare what the spies did to what Miriam did? For a very simple reason. Miriam spoke about a person. So I understand you speak about a person, you get punished. What are the spies speaking about? Sticks and stones. They're speaking about a land. The land doesn't have any feelings. The land doesn't care, we would think, if whether you speak about it or not. Rabbis are making the assumption. Here, they saw what happened when you speak against a person, you spoke Lashon Hara, and therefore she got punished. Ah, you should have learned not to speak Lashon Hara. It would have made more sense to me if it was what? The opposite. If they spoke against the land and they got punished, ah, how much more so you would speak against a person and you would get punished. I can learn the lesson much easier if it was first the land, and then if you get punished for a land, well, of course you'll get punished for a person. It seems more difficult to understand that if you get punished for a person, I should then assume that you would get punished for the land as well. So that's what we have to understand in this Rashi. Let's move on to the next Rashi. Shlach lecha nashim, send forth for yourself. The term lecha is a little bit out of place here. It should say, shlach anashim, send men. What is it, shlach lecha, you should send for yourself? What's that word lecha doing here? So Rashi tells us, lida'atcha, by your discretion. I do not command you to do so. If you wish, send forth. Very strange. God is saying, shlach lecha anashim, send for yourself men. Says Rashi, lest you think that this is a command. Like God tells us so many things in the form of a command. No. This is shlach lecha l'da'atcha. If you want to send, send. And if you don't want to send, well, that's also okay. It's a little strange. God's giving us the room to make a decision whether we want to or not. And Rashi continues, since Israel came and said, let us send men ahead of us. All of you approached me and said, let us send men ahead of us. And Moshe consulted the Shekhinah, and God said, I told them the land is good. As it says, I shall bring you from the afflictions of Egypt, etc. I swear by their lives that I give them room to err through the words of the spies so that they shall not take possession of it. So God says, you know, I told them it was a good land. They don't trust me, so you do what you want. If you want to send, that's great. I'm giving you that room to make the decision. A little bit odd. God's giving them this room. Either God commands them to send them or doesn't command them to send them. What's this idea here where God is giving us, so to speak, an option? We don't find too many precedences where God says, okay, do what you want. And then the second part of Rashi is also very troubling. So God says, you know what? I'm going to allow you to do whatever you want, but hey, hold on a second. I'm going to give them makom litot, room to err, which means, in a sense, I'm going to mess them up. So here, I'm allowing you to do whatever you want, but the end of Rashi says what? I'm going to mess them up. I'm going to give them room to make a mistake so that they will not take possession of the land. So how do we understand this Rashi? On the one hand, he's giving them room, and then on the other hand, he's saying, I'm going to mess them up. What does it mean that God says, I'm going to mess them up? So this is our work for today. Work is definitely cut out for us. Again, the overall question is, what was going on with the spies that they made such a terrible mistake. What was their mistake? And then more specifically, the first Rashi, how do we understand why is Rashi so concerned about the connection between the two stories? How are we to assume that they should have learned a lesson from Miriam? And the next Rashi, isn't it odd that God is giving them the room to make their own decision, and yet God is saying, I'm going to give them room to make a mistake? So we have enough questions to keep us for a while. Now let's get to an answer. In looking at the first Rashi of the connection between Miriam and the spies, the Maharel of Prague in source number 3, commentary of the Gur Aryeh on Chumash, notes that in reality, on a chronological level, the people did not ask for spies right here and now. The request had already been asked way beforehand by the Jewish people. Says the Maharal, when Rashi says, why are the two connected now? The reason is because chronologically they are not connected now. God is allowing the people to send spies specifically now because God wanted that the two stories should be juxtaposed again. So says the Maharal, if we take a look at where the arrow is, he says, it was not now, source 3, that they asked for spies. And he didn't agree to send them until now. Why did God wait, even though the request was in the request bin for a while? Why only now did he wait? Because he wanted them to learn from Miriam. So God is orchestrating the scene where they had a request to send out spies. God said, hold on a second, I don't want you to send them out just yet. He waited for the story of Miriam to happen. He waited for the appropriate event to happen before sending out the spies, so that the backdrop was set, so that now you have had the opportunity to learn from Miriam. Now with that opportunity behind you, go ahead, send out spies. I'm doing you a favor. I'm giving you a background. I'm giving you a lesson to learn from. So that's why Rashi is asking, well, why are the two placed together now? Because chronologically they don't belong together. But they are being placed together for this very reason, to learn a lesson. So now we get to our next question on this Rashi. Well, what is the lesson that they should have learned? So the first approach is the approach of Rav Schwab in Mayan Beit HaShoiva, which notes that, as we noted, we normally send source 4, that Ikar Isuro, the reason you cannot speak Lashon Hara, Hu Mechamat Sha'al Yado Mazikim Upogim B'Mishim Medabrim Allah, because you are going to hurt, offend the person you speak about. But we might say, if the person isn't going to be offended, or is not going to hear, or is not going to have any feelings about what we say, so then it would be okay to speak about them. So that's why we have the story of Miriam right before the story of the spies. Because who did Miriam speak about? Moshe Rabbeinu. How did Moshe Rabbeinu respond when he heard this? He didn't respond. You want to talk about me? That's fine. I have no hard feelings. He is the most humble person par excellence. He is a person which represents somebody who would not take personally, because of his anivus, because of his modesty, he would not take personally anything said about him. But nevertheless, he is, as Rav Schwab notes, a chesed de kedusha. He is an object of kedusha. He's avdi Moshe, God's servant. And even though he would not take personal offense, you have the audacity to speak about somebody who has so much holiness invested in him. What was the lesson of Miriam? That even if he's not going to take it personally, and even if he's not going to be offended by it, but he represents something which is an object of kedusha, an object of holiness, so then you can't speak about him, whether he takes offense or doesn't take offense. And that's the lesson of Eretz Yisrael. So says Rav Schwab, it's so beautiful, description of Eretz Yisrael. He says, V'chein Eretz Yisrael, hi chefsa de kedusha. The land of Israel is an object of holiness. As he says, Eretz Yisrael b'dargat ha-shamayim shamayim la-shem. It's God's. It belongs to Him. Umadu lo yareitem l'daber ba'artzi. Eretz asher nidoresh otam mireshit ha-shana ad acharit ha-shana. How dare you speak about a chesed of kedusha, an object of holiness, that God shows interest in it from the beginning of the year until the end of the year? So we ask, how could the Meraglim learn from Miriam? Is it in the backwards learning? The answer is no, they have very much something in common. Miriam spoke about someone who would not take personal affront, but because of what he stands for and who he is, it's wrong. Likewise, speaking about the land of Israel, even though sticks and stones have no feelings and can't really respond to what you say, since it's a chesed de kedusha, an object of holiness, you have to refrain from speaking bad about it. Just that parenthetically, there's a wonderful story on this pasuk that Rav Schwab quotes, that God is Doresh. He looks at the land from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. There was some Rebbe, and I forgot his name, who when he went to visit Israel, so as he's driving in the taxi from Lud to Yerushalayim, his eyes were pasted against the window. And people were talking to him in the car, and he just was looking outside the window. So they asked him, well, what's going on here that, you know, you're so interested in what's the scenery that is really forcing you to look outside? He says, this is called v'halachta v'drachav. You're walking God's ways. If God is involved in looking at the land from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, here I'm in the land walking God's ways, I also should be looking at the land. This is where my focus has to be, following God's ways, to focus in on the land, which is an interesting perspective of touring Eretz Yisrael, of a halachta v'drachah, of following God's ways, of God constantly watching the land. But it goes deeper than this. It goes much deeper than this. What's the connection between Miriam and the spies? It's not only a question that they both spoke about a chesed de kedusha, an object of holiness. Rav Michal Shmuzim, on the next page, Rav Michal was the Mashkiach of MTJ Yeshiva under Rav Moshe. So he says that there's something even deeper that connects the two together. He notes in Source 6, it would seem from this description of Moshe and Aaron's sin that their only mistake was not realizing that Moshe was qualitatively different from all other prophets. They believed that Moshe deluded himself into thinking that he was in a constant spiritual state as such as he experienced on Mount Sinai, when he did not eat or drink for 40 days, and that these delusions of grandeur had prompted him to refrain from marital relations. It is for this reason that Hashem made a point of noticing that the man Moshe is exceedingly humble. This unequivocally disproved their opinion about Moshe. Far from suffering delusions of grandeur, he was the humblest man in the world. And this is the reproach that Rashi notes to Miriam and Aaron. They should have realized that if Hashem has designated Moshe to be his chosen prophet, this should have been ample evidence of Moshe's exaltedness. And that, says Rav Michal, is so beautiful because it really gets to the root of our lives. The entire offense of Miriam and Aaron then was a failure to appreciate Moshe's high spiritual status. He thinks he's so great. God speaks to him. He can separate from his wife. God speaks to us. We don't separate from our husbands or wives. What did they lack? They lack seeing the greatness of Moshe. Since this episode of Miriam forms the very basis of the Torah's prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara, it can be said that the sin of Lashon Hara is rooted in this same problem, the failure to recognize the importance and true worth of one's fellow man. If we would make more of an effort to judge our fellow's actions favorably and to appreciate him according to his real value, we would never think or speak disparagingly of him. And this is such a powerful idea for our lives. When we speak negatively about a person, subconsciously or maybe perhaps consciously, we're not realizing the greatness of the person. Would we think of speaking about someone really great? What would we say? We'd be embarrassed to put someone great down. What gives us the right to speak negatively about somebody else? Because we don't think they're that great. We don't see inherently the greatness in this person, and therefore we disparage them. And that is the same problem with the spies. Says Rav Michal, Source 8 and 9, Source 8, that what was the spies' problem? they didn't see the greatness of the land. They didn't come to appreciate the greatness of the land. So why should the spies have learned from Moshe? The answer is simple, from Miriam. Because Miriam and Aaron did not appreciate the greatness of Moshe. They erred in really having a deeper understanding of what he's really about. So the spies likewise took a look at the land and did not see it on the level that they could have potentially seen it. They underestimated the holiness of the land. What does this mean, to underestimate the holiness of the land? So it's a great idea of Rav Schwab. Rav Schwab says the following, and we really have an understanding on this level of what where the spies went wrong. Spies come back, Tisha B'Av. We mourn every year Tisha B'Av. What's one of the ways we show our mourning? We read Megillat Eicha, the book of Eicha, book of Lamentations. It's a beautiful statement of our rabbis that says that if you look at the book of Eicha, this is a nice Tisha B'Av word, you'll notice that most of the chapters is an Aleph Bet format, Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet, right? And it follows alphabetically, with one exception. There are two letters out of place, the Pei and the Ayin. If you know the Hebrew alphabet, Ayin, and then comes Pei. If you look in the Megillat Eicha, the Pei is before the Ayin. It's inverted. What does Pei and Ayin represent? So Pei is literally the word Peh, mouth. And Ayin is literally an eye. So says the rabbis, why is Pei before Ayin, the end of 11? Bishvil meraglim sh'amru b'fihem ma shelo ra'u b'nehem. Because the meraglim, the spies, spoke, the Pei, they spoke what their eyes didn't see. They put their eyes before, they put their mouth before their eyes. They said things which they didn't see. So ask Rav Schwab, what's going on here? They saw giants, and they said they saw giants. They saw a land eating its inhabitants, so they said they saw a land eating its inhabitants. Everything that they said, they saw. So what does it mean that they put their mouth before their eyes? What's going on here? The pay before the ayin? So this is the key. 13. Hinei hushei ha'adam koltim dvarim olam hamuchash. Our senses bring into us the world of the concrete. Kifi tchunat v'nigiat bal hachush, depending on where our senses are at. It's possible. Shishnei anashim, two people, yisaklu al davar echad, will look at the same thing, and one will see orot kedusha, lights of holiness, and the other one will see sticks and stones. What's the classic example of this? We all know, source 14, is when Avraham Avinu went to the Akedah to sacrifice his son. And God said to him, I'll sacrifice your son on the mountain, then I'll tell you. Comes along the third day, the Pasuk says, Vayara tamakol merachok. He sees the place from afar. So Rashi notes, well, how did he know which place it was? Was there a big neon light, like the Hollywood light bulb, right? This is the place of the Akedah. So Rashi tells us, very famous, Ra'a anan kashur lahar. He saw a cloud on the mountain. So it's a great midrash, we all know this. He turns to Yitzchak and he says, Yitzchak, dear, do you see anything on this mountain? And Yitzchak responds, yes, I see a cloud hovering over this mountain. And then he turns to his two na'arim, his two servants, and says, do you see anything on this mountain? They say, yes, we see trees and sticks and stones and sand on this mountain. So says Abraham, Shvu lachem poi machamor, stay here with the donkey, because your level of seeing and the donkey's level of seeing are about on par with each other. You see the chumriyot, it's not only a donkey, you see the physicality of this world, you don't see beyond it. This is two individuals looking at a mountain. You can see an anan kashur lahar, a cloud on the mountain, or you can see sticks and stones on the mountain. And that, says Rav Schwab, was the problem, and this is answer number one to our original question. What went wrong with the meraglim? It was they put their eyes before their mouth. They looked at the land on a physical level. They did not look at it from a vantage point of spirituality. They went to Kiryat Arba, they went to the city of Hebron, and they saw giants there. Well, my friends, I have a secret for you. there were two sets of giants that they could see there. The giants who were the physical giants, those monsters that lived in the land. And what's the other option of a giant that lived in the land? Right, all the Avos that were buried in Hebron. Like Kalev who went to daven at the Kivrei Avos. You can go to Hebron and you can also see giants, but it's of a giants of a different nature. That was their mistake. They looked at the land from a purely physical level. You want us to come to this land? This land eats its inhabitants. This land is a difficult land to live in. Or you can look at this land as Kalev looked at this land and says, wow, this is such a holy, spiritual land. This is an amazing land to live in. And that's the concept of Peh La'ayim. As he says in the end of 15, Odot inyanim gashmim shel aretz. They only looked at the physicality of the land. Al kein hima ra'u be'emet rak etzim v'avanim. That's why they only saw the sticks and stone. V'lo ra'u riyam itit, and they didn't see a real ability, a real vision. V'nisha'er lahem lomar b'fihem. And therefore they said with their mouths, rak ma shelo ra'u be'nehem, what they did not see with their eyes, haruchaniim, their spiritual eyes. They just focused on the physical aspects and not on the spiritual aspect. That's putting their mouths before their eyes. Before looking at it on a spiritual level, they just spoke what they saw on a physical level. And that's why he notes, we say Eicha every year with a Peh and Ayim reverse, because that's what happens to Jewish people while they get thrown out of the land. They looked at living in Israel as living in any land. If they would have just but appreciated the spirituality of the land, so then their whole living in Israel would have been a different experience. Perhaps to concretize this idea of how do you look at the same thing on two different levels, there's a wonderful maisa, very famous story of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zichrono Livracha, right? Great gadol of our times. So Rav Shlomo Zalman once was walking home with a student. And as he was about to reach his front door, he began to tidy himself up, you know, put his jacket on nicely and straightened his hat. And he, you know, really made sure he was well presentable. So his student said, Kvod Harav, you have guests in your house that you're tidying yourself up for. I'll excuse myself. I'll allow you to be with your guests. So says Rav Shlomo, no, I don't have any guests. Please come in. So he says, Kvod Harav, you know, not to be too chutzpahdik, but, you know, I see the Rav is, you know, getting all dressed up to walk into his house. I'm assuming that they're guests there. He says, no, you don't understand. Our rabbis tell us that if there's peace between a husband and wife, Zohu, then Shechina Beinehem, God's divine presence is among them. My wife and I live in perfect harmony, one with each other. So I know there's a Shechina, there's a divine presence is in my home. So before I walk into my home, I'm tidying myself up because I'm about to meet the Shechina, I'm about to meet the Divine Presence. Two people can walk into a home. One person can walk in, and this is a home of sticks and stones, and another person can walk into a home and say, let me get myself ready because I'm greeting the Shechina, the Divine Presence, when I walk into my home. This is the difference that we're speaking about of how to approach the same exact item, but you can approach it from a vantage point of Kedusha, of holiness, or a vantage point of Chumrius, of the Chamor, of the physicalities of this world, and you miss out on the whole point. So on this level, what Rashi is telling us is that what should Miriam, what was the lesson of Miriam that the spies should have learned? It was the lesson of not underestimating and not depreciating Dvarim Shebe Kedusha, aspects of holiness, whether it's Moshe Rabbeinu on one hand, or whether it's the land of Israel. And that was their problem. They weren't able to appreciate it as much as they should have. They walked in with the wrong mindset. Bringing this Rashi of the connection between Miriam and the spies closer to our home in terms of what moral lesson can we learn, because we're also involved in a text study of Rashi today. So it's a beautiful idea that Rabbi Rucham notes in Das Torah in Source 17. And he says that one of the things that we learn from this Rashi is that Omnam min ha-chidushim she-chokhmat ha-musar is one of these novel ideas we learn from the concept of perfecting our moral behavior. B'chol asher ata ro'eh, whatever you see, b'chol ata shomea, whatever you hear, ha'ikar hi kabbalat talimudim, the key is to learn from it. Limsho kol hadrim elatzmecha ata, be able to bring it home to yourself, v'lahavi kol limud lidei ma'aseh, yishma chacham v'yosif lakach. In life, whatever you hear, whatever you see, growth are opportunities to learn from. As Rav Chaim Mordechai Katz tells the Rosh Yeshiva notes in Source 18, the wise person learns from everything that occurs to him. He tries to gain understanding from each occurrence. Even if he does not merit to gain a total understanding, the attempt to gain a deeper grasp of the matter in itself expands his mental scope. Being involved in the process, when you see something going on around you, ask yourself, why am I witnessing this? It's a very famous concept of the Baal Shem Tov, we're all familiar with, brought down in 19, that when you look into a mirror, you see your own blemishes. Think of other people as being your mirror. When you notice a defect or imperfection in someone else, that should tell you that you are tainted by the same shortcoming. It's a very fascinating way to view life. That when you meet other people, we're so easy to say, well, you know, this person's short-tempered, or this person is stingy, or this person, and we're very good at finding the faults in another person. Says the Baal Shem Tov, why do you find those particular faults in that person? There are probably a zillion faults, but something really strikes you about that person. And we all know this about ourselves, right? There's something that really irks us about somebody. Says the Baal Shem Tov, that's a mirror. That's a fault that you yourself have, and that's why it bothers you in somebody else, because it's something for you as an individual to work on. And everything around you is a mirror. I don't know if you've ever been to a restaurant. I'm sure it's happened to many of us here. You ever been to a restaurant where two people get into a real fight in the middle of the restaurant? Have you ever had this experience? Yes. Okay, we have a couple people who have this experience. Okay? And then you're asking yourself, isn't that embarrassing how two people are arguing in public like that? Aren't they ashamed about it? Stop and ask yourself, why were you there to witness such an event? What are you to learn from it? So instead of focusing on how embarrassing it is, how they're making fools of themselves, switch around the whole focus onto self. What can you learn from this environment? What can you learn from these situations? And that's the key in life. What Rashi is telling us, and this is what the Maharal is getting at, is why are these two stories put together? Because life is about learning from experiences. Life is about not just living in a small little, you know, abstract existence, but when events happen around you, learn from them. They are the guiding tools to make you a better person. And that's what the Sichas Musar says in 20. The lesson of this saying of our sages is that the purpose of God's punishment is corrective, to notify the recipient that he must mend his ways. Thus the Meraglim, the spies, were taken to task for having witnessed punishment for a deed similar to theirs, the sin of Lashon Hara, and having failed to take this lesson. And this is also why he says that divine retribution is meted out, mida keneged mida, measure for measure. It is to enable a person to pinpoint a sin and to improve that which needs correction. Everything that happens to us in life, even the punishments that come on a person, are not by accident. They're clearly, if we can understand them, and sometimes it's not so easy to understand them, they're there for us to learn a lesson. And just since we noted it at the beginning, very famous Rashi, it's one that's always good to think about when you're about to speak Lashon Hara, that the spies were punished, mida keneged mida, measure for measure. Things don't happen by accident. What was the punishment that they died in? 21. They died in a manner befitting them, measure for measure. They sinned with their tongues, and consequently their tongues protruded from their mouth, reaching their stomachs, and worms crawled to and from their tongues. Hence it says, really gruesome, right? Before God, meaning by the manner in which Hashem inflicts punishment, measure for measure. So on a deeper level, what this Rashi is teaching us is that everything that happens in life is meant for us to learn from, whether it's people we meet, situations that happen to us, things that happen to us as corrective measures, all of these things are Yishma Chacham V'Yosef Lekach. They're in order to make us better and more developed people to learn from that which happens around us. So this is level number one, Rashi number one. So just in summation, Rashi is telling us is that the meragling, the sin of the spies, was they devalued the Kedusha, the holiness of the land. They looked at it with their eyes instead of their mouths, which means they put their eyes before their mouth, which means that they did not see the kedusha, the holiness in the land. They looked at it from a vantage point of physicality, not a vantage point of spirituality. And what Rashi is teaching us is that they should have learned from Miriam. God sets up situations in our lives. The things that happen to us are meant to teach us lessons. In looking now at the second Rashi, we're going to take a whole different approach of what happened with the spies. The second Rashi, as we recall, dealt with God saying, if you want to send spies, great, but I'm warning you, I'm going to mess you up. So the first thing we need to understand is, since when does God give us options? Do whatever you feel like. Seems a little bit out of place. Right? Take, for example, last week's parasha of Pesach Sheni. The people wanted to, right, they were tamid lenefesh, they were impure, they wanted to bring a second korban. So God doesn't say, well, those who want to bring a Pesach Sheni can bring a Pesach Sheni. There's a Pesach Sheni, so you have to bring it. What does this mean if you want to send, if you don't, don't? So here again in the writings of the Sichos of the Rebbe, book translated in English in the Garden of Torah, he makes a very, very important insight into life. We know there's a famous Rambam, famous statement of Maimonides in Hilchos Tshuva in the fifth chapter that says that every person is fit to be righteous, source 24, like Moshe, our teacher, or wicked like Yeruvim. There's no one who compels him, decrees upon him, or leads him to either of these two paths. As we know, the Torah tells us, behold, I set before you today life and good, death and evil, and the choice is ours. God did not create man to be an automaton. Instead, he gave him free choice, which distinguishes him from all other forms of life. All other existence is ruled by the laws of nature, but we can take our own initiative. And here the Rebbe notes that there are two ways of taking an initiative. 1 in 25 is obedience to the mitzvot of the Torah, where God has given us a multifaceted set of deeds which we are obligated to perform and others which we are forbidden to perform. And our power of choice enable us to control and negate any inner obstacles that hinder the fulfillment of God's will. So there's one level of our lives which is dictated and directed by God's command. You have to do this, you can't do this. You have to do that, you can't do that. Where does our free choice come in? Are we going to indeed listen or we're not going to listen? That's where the free choice comes in. I'm going to keep Shabbos or I'm not going to keep Shabbos. I'm going to say a bracha, I'm not going to say a bracha. That's our free choice in the realm of obedience. But then there's a much higher level, and a much deeper level. And that's in 26. Molding one's character to conform to God's will, even when there is no explicit commandment to do so. To explain, there's an entire realm of activities referred to as reshut, what is permitted. We are not told what we must do, nor what we must avoid. But that does not mean there's no godly mode of conduct appropriate for these activities. The initiative, however, is ours. We must strive to discover God's will and then shape our characters accordingly. And if we think about it, most of our lives, believe it or not, are in this gray area called reshut. Right? We go to work, we do laundry, I don't know, whatever it is, carpool, dry cleaning, life, right? Go out to a restaurant with a friend, whatever it is. However we spend our beautiful days on this earth, a lot of our lives is an area of reshut, which means God's not telling you what to do or how to do it, but the very act of living has the ability to conform oneself into a model of a servant of God. So even though you may not be involved in any specific command, your whole being, the whole way you present yourself can be one of a godly nature or not of a godly nature. In the area of command, that's very easy. Well, this is what I'm supposed to do, this is not what I'm supposed to do. What is more difficult? When there is no direct command and a person has to form themselves and ask oneself the question, am I acting in a godly manner right now? Is this something appropriate to me created in the image of God? And that's a far more difficult question to ask oneself. 27, the task of molding one's character represents a more complex expression of our potential for free choice. When a commandment has been given, even though man has the option of obeying or not obeying, the fact that God has given the command spurs obedience. Moreover, when God's will is explicit, the choice facing man is clear. On the other hand, when God has not given an explicit command, and man has to elevate and refine himself until he appreciates what is expected of him, the challenge and the choice are far more encompassing. And now we can understand this Rashi so much deeper. This approach 28 to divine service represents the new dimension contributed by this week's Torah reading. The reading begins, Shlach Lecha, you may send. Right? And the Rashi that we did, it's up to you. I'm not commanding you if you desire send. What's going on here? So this is the whole point. 29, this represented a new phase in our people's relationship with God. Previously, the Torah had related the commandments which God had given Moshe for the conduct of the Jewish people. But now, 31, more particularly, this dwelling, 30, this new approach to divine service, that the initiative be given to man, is associated with the objective of the spies' mission, our people's entry into the land of Israel. The goal of life in Israel is to fashion a dwelling for God within the realities of everyday life. When they were living in the desert, they were living by God's command. They didn't really have this room of reshut where they were free to explore this world and then become a godly person within those parameters. More particularly, 31, this dwelling should be established by man's initiative. Were the dwelling to be established by revelation from above, it would be incomplete. Man, as he exists within his own context, and the power of creativity he possesses, would not be reflected within it. When, by contrast, man transforms his own will, and on the basis of this inner metamorphosis, proceeds to transform his surroundings, God comes to dwell within our existence. So one's sitting at home, and just interacting with one's family, so there's no mitzvah going on perhaps at that moment. But the way you talk to people, the way you walk down the street and greet other people, the way you say thank you at Ralph, these are all things that are called menschlichkeit, which perhaps may not have a mitzvah attached to them, but it's transforming our whole existence, that whole thing called life, the whole thing called existence, into a godly structure. And let us not fool ourselves and think that this is easy. Because when it's black and white, so then I know what to do. But in those areas that I have to take the initiative and I have to come out and make myself a godly person, that's a tremendous challenge. And there's tremendous room to mess up as well. And here on this level, this is how at least one Hasidic approach, Rebbe brings it down, explains why the spies didn't want to go into the land. Why didn't they want to go into the land? For this reason. We are living on such a high spiritual level in the desert. How can we risk going into the land and going onto that whole level of Shlach Lecha L'dakcha in the whole level of Rishut? If you want to send, send. That Rashi is really signifying that whole new mode of conduct that was going to be found in the land of Israel. It's the conduct of you make your own choice. You have to create a spiritual environment. Said the spies, let's do it inside. The possession of the land of Israel, 33 of the arrow is, meant a new kind of responsibility. The manna was to cease. Bread would come only through toil. The providential miracles were replaced by labor. And with labor came the danger of a new preoccupation. The spies were no ordinary men. They were princes of the tribes, especially selected by Moshe for their mission. And their anxiety was a spiritual one. Their fear was that a concern to work the land and make a living might eventually leave the Israelites with progressively less time and energy for the servants of God. They said it is the land which eats up its inhabitants, meaning that the land and its labor and the preoccupation with their materialistic world would swallow up and consume all their energies. That's what it means, Eretz Ochlel Yosheveha, a land that eats up their inhabitants. Their opinion was that the spirituality flourishes best in seclusion and withdrawal in the protected peace of the wilderness where even the food was from the heavens. And that's where they were wrong. 34, because the purpose of a life lived in Torah is not the elevation of the soul as much as the sanctification of the world. The end to which every mitzvah ends is to bring God to the light within the world, not above it. And therefore, all the miracles that happened in the desert were really a preparation for the real task, taking possession of the land of Israel and making it a holy land. And that explains why when Kali was trying to convince the people we can make it into the land, we would think that what Kali would say is, look at all the miracles that happened. If God could do all these miracles, of course He could bring them into the land. But if we understand it on this level, that's all wrong. We know we can live on the level of miracles. That's not the kunz. The kunz is, can we live in a land where we don't see God every day and yet elevate ourselves to that level? And this is Kali's answer, the arrow in 34 to the 10th spot. Let us go up. Let us indeed go up and inherit the land. In other words, let us go up twice over. We have ascended to the spirituality of the wilderness. We have risen above the concerns of the world. Now let us make a new and greater ascent, finding God within the world itself. Let us possess the land not as someone who buys something from a stranger, but as someone who inherits something because of his oneness with its owner. On this level, the spies didn't want to go into the land because they were afraid of the spiritual challenge of the land. If we live in a cocoon, if we live with man from heaven, we live drinking, this is the perfect protected environment to flourish in a relationship with God. How can we risk it by going into a land which consumes its inhabitants, that eats us up? And this is their mistake. The whole desert experience was just to prepare us for the challenges of living in this world and being elevated, being able to elevate this world. And not only in the areas of mitzvahs, but more particularly in the areas of reshut and the permissive areas, where that's where our challenge is. Shlach lecha l'datcha, if you want to be able to make decisions in life and decisions that are going to be elevate you as an individual to a godly existence. Final idea for today, and then we'll summarize. How do we understand then the end of Rashi? Well, I'm going to mess you up, right? I'm going to give you room to err. So this is also a very important idea in terms of bringing Rashi, as we saw in the last Rashi, bringing it home to a moral lesson for our lives. Let's see the moral lesson in this Rashi for our lives. Says Rabbeinu Yerucham in Das Torah in 38, what does this statement mean? Shani no tein lahem makom litoth, room to make a mistake. High noon, this is very beautiful. Ki lo yiyeh ezer Hashem imam lo'akvam mechato. God will not help them, stop them from sinning. Asher hanagat ha'akva, the concept of God being able to hold us back. La'amsi la'adam ikuvim shonim lumano mechato, hi'ikara tzlacha la'adam b'avodat Hashem. There's this concept, and perhaps we're not familiar with it, but I'll give you some concrete examples, I think we'll see it. Where God helps us out in life, stopping us from sinning. And this is a gift that God gives us all the time to enable us to be good Torah people. Here's an example that I'm sure has happened to all of us. You're sitting with a friend, and you're about to tell them a piece of Lashon Hara. At that moment that you're about to speak, what happens? The phone rings, the doorbell rings, somebody comes in and interrupts you. Here's your challenge. That clearly is what we're talking about here. God comes down from above and says, stop. I'm giving you an opportunity not to sin. The phone call's over. The person at the door leaves. The person who interrupted you leaves. Now, do you say, well, where was I? Or do you say, you know, let's change the conversation or just pick up a new piece of conversation? These are the gifts of God that happen to us all the time. You're eating a piece of food, you weren't planning on saying a bracha, and somehow it falls out of the fork, it falls out of the spoon. Right? So what do? Just pick it up and eat it, or say, hold on a second. That you know, twitch of the hand, was that not but a little message from above, I'm stopping you, preventing you from falling into a pitfall. Life, and it's all a question of how we view life, and that's why the shiur today is called perspective, because everything is a question of our perspective. Are we able to see that there's so many times in life where God just stands in the way, the motto he brings down in 40 of the malach, of the angel by Bilam, who's standing in the sword in the way, and as a rabbi tells us, it was a malach shel rachamim, an angel of mercy, stop! We have all these angels, all these experiences that happen along our way that help us from sinning. What does it mean that God's going to make us room to mess up? It means He's going to take away that help. And if we take away that help, So then we're open to the forces around us, and we will more easily come to sin. If we don't realize that we have this help, and we don't ask God for this help, so then we're really opening ourselves up to more of an opportunity to fall. As our rabbis tell us, Haba L'Tahir, in the middle of 39, one who comes to be purified, Nisayinoto, God helps him out. Haba L'Tahir, one who's coming for impurity to sin, so it doesn't say Nisayinoto, God's going to help him reach this level of impurity. That's not so nice. But rather, the Lashon of Chazal is, Palschim Lo, God give them an opening. God is not going to stand at the gate and creating obstacles to stop the person. And that's the lesson I think we can learn from this end of Rashi, where he said, I'm going to let you send spies, you make the decision. But I'm not going to be there to stop them. I'm not going to be there to make sure that they don't mess up. I'm leaving them to their own devices. As we know, when we're left to our own devices, without siyata dishmaya, without help from heaven, how easily we can fall. So I think if we just summarize what we've seen today, what was the sin of the spies? So on the first level, the sin of the spies was the lack of appreciation of the land of Israel. This is what the spies should have learned from Miriam. The root of Lashon Hara is a depreciation, a lack of recognition of how important and special people are. They looked at the same mountain and saw sticks and stones, and they were unable to see the Shekhinah, the spirituality of the land. On the second level, what was the problem of the spies? That they were afraid that if we would go into the land, that we would not have the ability, to be able to really serve God. It's much easier to serve God in a cocoon, and that's how they, these great men, wanted to live. That's why God says, Shlach lecha l'datcha, you're about to go into the land of Israel. It's a new mode. It's a mode called Rishut. It's not the level of obligation of do this and don't do that. A higher challenge is to live in the land, live as normal people. But live as normal people, as godly people, even if you don't have a command every second of your life how to live a life. Take the initiative. Take the choice and know exactly how to live your life. In reality, the two, if we think about it, really are not in contradiction. The real root of the problem, the spies, was the inability to see the spirituality in the land. If they were able to see the spirituality inherent in the land, then they would be able to see as well that you can live in a land and not in a cocoon, and yet with the help of God, be able to grow and be able to accept the challenges of that free choice and be able to live a Torah lifestyle. And that's really, I think, the messages that come out of these Rashis for our lives, of being able to take a look around us, that God is very much a focal point of our lives. He sets up situations and people that we meet in order to be mirrors to us, to teach us lessons. And God is around at all times in order to help us out or to stop us from sinning. And again, I think the whole basis is a question of perspective. Are we able to look at the situations around us? Are we able to see the way God helps us in life? And in so doing, if we're able to see that, so we're able to have more of a spiritual vantage point of looking at life, of seeing the anan kashur lahar, the cloud on the mountain, and we'll be able to elevate our lives even in the open of Rashut, even in the matters which are not directly commanded to us, to live a life of closeness to God.